Welcome to Recovery Internet Radio, broadcast from Straight Stuff Studios. I was going to say live and direct, but we're doing a little bit different format now. So I hope you're enjoying listening to this wherever you are, be it downloaded via podcast or anyway. Thanks for joining us here tonight. We've got a good show for you. I want to introduce our host this week and every show, Mr. Rick Atwater.
Okay.
I'm the only one clapping. There's not a lot of people here.
So. Deafening applause.
Deafening. Okay. I can add that in later.
Right. Yeah, we can add the applause later. Anyway, hi and welcome to Recovery Internet Radio and our show, Straight Stuff on Addictions. Our tag tonight is grinding down the sharp edges. How's that? That works for you?
That works for me.
Yeah. It was close. You said stones, and I just sort of morphed it a little bit, but we'll get there. Anyway, thanks for joining us tonight, Phil, where we are every Sunday night at 7. Thanks to our engineer, Chris.
Yo.
Deafening applause.
Hey. Oh,
there's that sign again. remember to check out recoveryinternetradio.com. That's
recoveryinternetradio.com.
Okay. For all our archive shows and recovery resources. And we do keep all of our past shows on the website that you can access in the archive section. Is that what it says on the website?
That's what it says on the right. You just click listen, and you know it seems like go to listen, and then you could listen to the most current show, or you can go back to the archives.
And there's probably, we always debate about the number of shows that we've done, but we know we've got, it was 2 years worth of shows in at the end of April. So, along with a couple of reruns along the way, we've probably got, 120 shows that we've done, give or take.
Give or take.
So that's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of good material in there that people can make use of. So we hope you do. So I'd like to get started, if we can, if you're up, ready to go, ready to rock.
I'm good, Rick.
Okay, Phil, we're good. I guess what I'd like to do is maybe just start by asking you a little bit about like some of the first recollections you have with your dance with alcohol and other substances. When did that? What's your first recollection?
My first recollection was my aunt's wedding. I think I was about 6 or 7.
Hmm.
And nobody had a lot of money, so her reception was in our garage.
Hmm.
And I was sipping beer all night. And then I didn't feel good, and I threw up all over my uncle's back when he picked me up. And ever since then, it was just, when there was beer out, my grandpa would give me a sip, my dad would give me a sip. And occasionally, when there was a party, I'd grab a couple of these beers and I'd put them and I'd hide them in my room. And I remember in fourth grade, I wrapped one up in tinfoil like everybody else did when we went on a field trip in school, and everybody else was drinking cans of pop, and I was drinking an old style.
And you're like in junior high?
No, it would have been fourth grade.
Oh, fourth grade, grammar school.
Yeah.
Okay.
I wasn't drinking it to, I didn't correlate the. I just thought it was a cool thing to do.
Yeah, it was
kind
just
of an adult thing.
Yeah, and carbonated beverage.
Yeah, yeah. My first real drunk, though, was when I was 12 years old with a buddy of mine. It was Halloween night. We went to the local haunted house, he had gotten a...
Was that the one on Barlena? That one... The Algonquin one, or was there
no?
Another
it
one?
Was in Schaumburg, and
oh,
it was called the Barn, and it was the old police station.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was the old police station like 2 years before this. So, and it was sponsored by the Athletic Association. So there's a good showing of responsible adults and police in the area there.
Mm-hmm.
And my buddy happened to get an uncrapped fifth of Southern Comfort 100 proof.
Hmm.
And we ate candy and drank that bottle.
Mm-hmm. Which tastes like candy, kind of, with a burn.
Yeah, it didn't taste bad.
Yeah, it's kind of sweet.
Yeah, yeah, it was a little sweet. I remember burping, it didn't taste too good.
Oh, yeah.
But, mix it up with a bunch of chocolate and drink it down.
Did you get sick that night?
I didn't get sick. we had this plan that he was going to sleep over at my house because my mom was away for the evening.
Yeah.
Which was pretty common for her to do.
Yeah.
And I had the house that everybody came to because my parents were divorced and my mom was always out on dates.
Mm.
So he came over to the house and we were sitting down and, you know, I was feeling the effects of this pretty good. And he was too because his head was just bobbling back and forth. And all of a sudden, I just remember him spewing vomit out about 4 feet, oof, all over the carpeting. And
this is your house?
This was my house.
Yeah, this is good.
5 seconds after that, my mom came home.
Mm.
And it wasn't a good thing. This kid's dad was about 7 foot tall and just a hulk of a man. And my mom called him and he came over and he picked this kid up by the hair and lifted him straight up in the air and drug him out to his car.
Mm.
And I thought, what's the big deal? Tasted pretty good. I like the way I feel.
Hmm. Yeah. Have you heard, I mean, I have heard some people say that they were alcoholic from pretty much the first time they ever drank. Do you think that that fits you?
Yes, I would say so. I would say so.
Like you kind of came out of the gate predestined, or I don't know what the right word would be, but kind of like just add, you know, alcoholic, just add booze kind of a guy?
Yeah, that's how my parents were. That's how the majority of my family was. And
Your parents had both had alcohol problems?
Yes. Yes, they did. They would drink and they would fight.
Mm.
They would drink and they would fight. And that was about it as a childhood, my childhood.
Mm. I had a cop friend of mine tell me once that if he worked the night shift, and he said, you know what, if mainly what I do is domestics and DUIs. So if we took the booze out of the equation, 95% of my calls wouldn't exist.
Yeah, I would.
It would probably, you know, really, really bang his business.
Yeah, it sure would.
Yeah. So they drank, they fought, they drank, they fought. You think that affected you?
I think it did. I think it really affected my self-esteem and such. You know, my father's parents and my father actually moved here from Austria, and it was the old world for them. You know, you don't show any weakness.
Mm.
And it was just a constant, I look back at it now, and it was a constant, belittlement and sarcasm. You know, it was a barrage of it all the time.
From both, or just mostly from your dad, or?
Mostly from my dad. Then my mom was normally so aggravated that she had no compassion, and she would just scream and yell.
Hmm.
I remember one day she chucked a, remember a cleanser, Comet, used to come in those hard containers,
like
little round bricks, you know, about 8 inches tall.
Especially if it was full.
It was full and brand new, and it came flying at me, and it knocked me to the ground.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was kind of my
so
childhood.
When that happened, how does a guy who doesn't show weakness handle that?
You don't have a lot of choices. You go to your room.
Yeah? You don't cry?
You don't cry in front of anybody.
Hmm. Yeah. And when you're in your room, what do you think?
I get mad and angry.
Hmm.
Pull over the dressers, you know, punch holes in the wall, kick the door in, you know, a whole lot of
angry. Them. Yeah.
Yeah, angry.
Well, I mean, you saw anger and you experienced anger, so what are you supposed to, I suppose, what would a kid think?
Yeah, I didn't know any better. Had I known any better, I probably would have done different, but I didn't have the capacity at that point.
No, and you're talking about when you were like what, in you know, grade school?
Grade school, yeah.
Hmm. Yeah. So yeah, because you know, I mean, this we'll end up, you know, talking about this as we go. But that's where the whole grinding down the sharp edges. Now we're talking about the sharp edges, I guess, aren't we?
Yeah, I've got a lot of sharp edges, even preteen.
Yeah, yeah. And so how did that? So how were you like when you were out in the world?
I was an angry guy.
Like, what would the thing be like if we saw Phil coming, we'd go, don't mess with that guy?
Yeah, or, get out of the way, step back, don't even say hi to him.
Really?
Yeah.
Or you might give him an excuse to whoop your ass?
Yeah, or at least try.
But you didn't mind trying?
I didn't mind trying, and if I didn't get you now, I'd get you later.
Yeah.
That was kind of my MO.
Yeah. Yeah, I get you.
There's four of us now. We can give him a good whooping, but he's going to come back and get every one of us.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was...
That would be called a grudge?
Yeah, yeah. A grudge, a resentment, you know.
You know, I was just thinking about how, you know, some you've heard of people who are cutters, where they cut themselves,
right,
and they, in some weird way, when they cut themselves, it relieves their pain, and they, you know, they get some sense of, it's almost, you know, seems like that violence is almost like that. It's like that pain of that anger, which is self-destructive, actually is some kind of weird relief.
Well, Rick, I associate it now with, you know, a large lady,
mm-hmm,
who's going out to eat, who's wearing kind of tight clothes,
mm-hmm,
and you know, she's kind of stuffed in those clothes pretty tight, and she's wound up really tight. She puts a couple more bites in, and at the least opportune moment, those pants are going to split open, and everything's going to be hanging out. And that's kind of how my anger was. But it, you know, I did get a release.
Yeah.
When I expressed it through anger.
So what was it? That's a very interesting picture that you just painted, Phil. but like, what were you filling up with? Have you figured that out since? Like, you know, you were filling up with something.
Yeah, I was filling up with self-centered fear.
Okay. You probably didn't know that until a whole lot later, though. A whole lot later. And I suppose we probably have to work our way there. So we'll go back. But so another question I had was, since you didn't have a lot of supervision, you didn't have parents that were telling you really much about what's right to do, what's not right to do, where did you get your values?
I didn't have many values, pretty much from other kids, and the only kids I hung out with were kind of just like me. You know, so our values were... pretty much whoever can be the biggest jag is,
mm-hmm,
he's the king of the pack today, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Whoever can do the most ridiculous thing.
Like risky, illegal, what?
Yeah, anything. You know, one night we were stealing the cherries off of police cars.
Hmm.
You know, and that was a thing, you know, that was the cool thing to do then. You know, another night we were... taunting people to get into fights, and whoever got the best blow in first, you know, that was it. And it didn't matter who people were, you know, it was kind of indiscriminate.
Hmm.
It was some really pretty crazy times.
And this is all like junior high.
Junior high years.
So how do we progress then into did you get them?
No, he's fast.
Yeah, he is. He'll be back over here in a minute. So there he is. So we progress into high school, and like, what's happening for you when you get to high school?
High school was a little tough for me getting in, because I was pretty big as a kid.
Yeah.
You know, at 13, I think I was almost 6 foot tall, and 175 pounds, and I was a big kid. I'd play football, and I'd hurt a lot of people.
Yeah.
Playing football. So high school is a little tough, because when you come in and you're the biggest kid, everybody walks right up to the biggest kid and wants to fight.
Right.
And I had an older sister that preceded me in high school, and she had become involved with kind of the kids that were on the wrong side of the tracks. The crowd that would hurt people.
Yeah.
You know, so... You know, once that word kind of got around, I didn't have much of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But I was just angry.
Yeah. What was your drinking like in high school?
You know, we used to inject vodka with my buddy's. His father had hypodermic needles because he was diabetic. But we'd fill we'd take an orange and we'd squeeze out all the juice, and then we'd fill it back up with vodka.
Mm.
And then this incredible thing happened back then. And when I became a sophomore, they had something that was called Open Campus, which they don't have anymore. They'd let you go out and party at lunchtime, and half the time we wouldn't go back to school. So, you know, we'd go to somebody's house, and I was pretty good at breaking into liquor cabinets, you know, taking the hinges off, picking the lock, you know, whatever. So that was, it was pretty much a daily event, or, you know, marijuana use was big. And towards the, you know, the middle years of high school, some of the other drugs came in, some of the different micro dot type deals, and, you know, some fields, and, you know, stickers you put on your forehead, and... Cocaine was a big thing.
And I take it that you were sampling all of the above?
I was sampling all the above and more. And if I didn't have anything, I'd open up a can of rubber cement. You know, I was...
And sniff that?
Yeah. I learned that when I was a kid, putting models together. It was a good feeling when you put models together in a small room. So I would use just about anything I could get my hands on.
What would you say the percentage of days in high school that you weren't, that you didn't get high at all?
Maybe 10%.
Hmm. Yeah. How were your grades?
My grades actually were pretty good.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. They had me in the remedial classes at the beginning of high school. And I wasn't doing well in them because I was in the regular classes. Then they put me in remedial classes. And, you know, then they figured out I was just bored with all the work.
Right.
And then they put me in advanced classes.
Right.
And I'd never, gosh, I don't think I studied for a test. And
you were high 90% of the time.
Yeah.
And you still did okay.
I did okay with that. You know, I had pretty decent grades. And then the last 2 years of school, I was involved in the co-op program. So I only had to go to school for 2 hours in the morning.
And then went to work.
Yeah, yeah. I was out of school at gosh, I think like 9:15 in the morning. They didn't want me there either. And,
you know, that worked out well for everybody.
Yeah, they identified me as non-college bound and thought that that would be an appropriate schedule for me, something that would benefit me.
That's interesting, though, that you, they identify you as non-college bound, but you're in advanced classes getting good grades. You're just a troublemaker.
I was a troublemaker.
Yeah.
Yeah, I, you know, there was a football game, and the opposing team's principal was there, and he drove this white Corvette there. And me and my buddies got on that car and stomped the hell out of that car with our black Colorado hikers on. Oh. And, you know, they found out it was us, and the police consultant had us all locked up in there, and he didn't want to press charges because he was afraid of what might happen to him. He just asked to be left alone.
So you were really that was like more like the kind of thing that would happen if there were gangs.
Yeah, there wasn't too many gangs in Schaumburg at that time, but I guess there kind of was.
And kind of apparently there kind of was, and you were kind of the leader. No, you weren't the leader?
You know, there were different generation of gangs. There were some older kids, there were some younger kids, and there was, you know, people from Schaumburg, and then there was people from Hoffman Estates and people from Streamwood, and we'd have, you know, rumbles behind the roller skate rink, you know. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't really any knives or guns. It was just, you know, chains and bats and pipes and stuff. People would get hurt, but nobody would get not like today where they're shooting each other.
You know, it was interesting. I went into a BD, a behavior disorder class in a local high school. This was about, I don't know, wow, gosh, 10 or 15 years ago now. And there was, I guess there was maybe, I think there were, to be precise, there were 11 kids in the class. And so we did a little survey and asked them a little bit about themselves and a little bit about their family life. And of the 11 kids in the class, all 11 came from alcoholic families.
Imagine that.
Yeah. Yeah, imagine that. And, you know, I mean, so it just goes to the label that you got. I mean, you didn't have a chance.
No, when I look back at it and there's no structure, there's no value system.
You didn't have a chance, dude.
No, and that's where I see these kids today, you know.
No, but what's sad is that you're smart. You know, I know you're smart. And, you know, you're obviously, you know, I mean, as the story continues, people, I think, will pick that up because didn't you, like, have a house? Tell me that part about your mom was leaving for Florida or something.
She was. She met a guy, and she was going to move to Florida with this guy, so she was putting the house on the market, and she said she was going to move in at my grandma's house in an apartment in Chicago for a couple of months until they left town, and there wouldn't be room for me there, so I should really think about what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
And gosh, the house sold in like a month.
Mm.
And I really didn't comprehend what was going on, and I still had all my stuff there, and you know, I was going to camp out and says, well, the new people can move in, I'm still going to live in my room. You know,
yeah, that's my room. What are you talking about?
Attitude, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Just live wherever you want. I don't care.
Yeah. I don't really care.
Yeah.
So I ended up having to, I went to this roommate locating service, and I got a roommate, and I shared an apartment with a guy for like a year while I saved some money.
Mm-hmm.
And
because you were working, by that time, you were working for, well, this is when you were 17. You were still in high school?
Yeah, I was still in high school. And interesting enough, I was working at the same place that I currently work today.
Mm.
I just have a different position today.
Yeah, I bet you do. But so you were making pretty decent money for a kid your age at that time?
Yeah, I was making decent cash, and I was working a different job in the evenings.
Mm-hmm.
And I also, kind of about this time, I came up with this little thing of this, you know, that involves some marketing and distribution. And I had some good skills with marketing and distribution. And mm-hmm. I also had good skills to collect the funds for the marketing and distribution, you know, so mm-hmm. I did pretty good with that.
Yeah, yeah. Kind of a pyramid scheme kind of a thing? Or was it a sole proprietorship?
Well, it was a pyramid, but I wasn't at the top of the pyramid. That would have been the guy that had the garbage bags full.
Right.
And I would come home with, you know, a half a garbage bag full.
Yeah.
And I would make like, you know, whatever you get out of it, like 8 or 12 full Ziploc baggies full.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the lower you got in the amounts, the more money you made, but the more people you had to deal with. So.
Right. So you were kind of more or less a wholesale broker level guy.
Yeah, all the money I made at work kind of went into an account, and I mm-hmm. didn't spend much of it. And my expenses and my party and money all came from
the other source.
From the other source.
Yeah. And so that money that you saved, you bought a house?
Yeah, yeah. The employer I worked for, the place transferred owners. And I found out that, you know, I was 100% vested, and I had a good sum of money already in there.
Mm-hmm.
In what they called back then, like a pension plan.
Right.
And
so when they sold the company, that pension money became available to you as
it
a...
It did.
As a,
it did.
Whatever, as a buyout thing or...
Yeah, so I was able to tap into that, and I used that for a down payment on a house.
And you were how old, 18?
I was 18 or 19.
Yeah, yeah. And that's pretty young to own a house, but it's also, when you think about it, how many people at age 19 can figure out how to do that, are responsible enough to have a job and save their money, even if they're doing it, some of the activities are illegal, can put that together. I don't think very many.
No, I actually had to have my grandma write a note that she gave me the money and I didn't have to pay her back because I couldn't show where all the money came from.
Yeah. But still, I mean, so, okay, so you have a house, and you live in this house, what for the next, you know, for quite a while, because I think we were talking about...
Yeah, I think I was in that house for about
19
four, maybe
to,
5 years.
Yeah, and then what was that Party Central?
I kind of tried to keep a low profile at that house.
Did you?
I did. I would go out and party, and, you know, I drank alone. A lot. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times I would just hang out at the house and, you know, get hammered.
Yeah. Did you think there was anything odd about that?
No, I really didn't. I did think once in a while, though, when, you know, when it was garbage day, and that's when they just started this recycling program,
mm-hmm.
and they'd give you these little yellow bins.
Yeah.
And even if I crushed the cans, they wouldn't all fit in this bin, and I'd have... I thought, you know, there's so many cans, and I would just save the bags, and I would take them to the junkyard, but that really wasn't worth it. It was only a couple of bucks, so I was throwing them out. And then, you know, I'm kind of thinking I got a lot more than a lot of other people.
Yeah.
And yeah. it was. I didn't see them outside every night drinking in the summertime, like by themselves. You know.
Yeah.
When I went outside to drink, the neighbors would all go inside.
Why was that?
I don't think I was very sociable.
Oh, you think were they afraid of you?
I think I might have been a little intimidating.
Yeah.
Because I would never have a smile on my face. I would always look angry. Got people away like that. You know, you didn't have to explain anything. Because they'd ask you, how's your day? What's going on? And you know what? You're smiling. You're happy. I'm grumpy. I suck. I hurt inside. Screw you.
Yeah. The next thing you know, you'd have to explain. And you really don't want to explain. And so this way, you don't have to
keep everybody away.
You don't have to explain anything to anybody.
No. I'd have roommates move in for a while, you know, and, you know, then move out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the flavor of the month type thing, you know, or a buddy on hard times, you know, there's a bedroom, have fun.
Mm-hmm.
And that would last about a month until, you know, I felt they were taking advantage of me or, you know, whatever. And
yeah.
Take a hike.
So do you think that having that house and living that way contributed to, you know, how things were progressing with your disease?
Yes, it did. I think it gave me an opportunity to completely almost eliminate myself from society.
Hmm.
So I didn't have to participate.
Went to work, came home, and drank?
I went to work, I came home, and I'd always, you know, like on different days, I would go to different stores to buy alcohol because the guy would look at me funny when I kept going to the, you know, the grog shop is what it was. I'd stop at the, you know, the local liquor store. When I'd stop in and buy a case or two, you know, every day. You know, yeah. He started looking at me funny, so I started going to different places.
Yeah, but you probably didn't. It didn't register that. I mean, you may have felt a little embarrassed that you were buying a lot of liquor at the same place, and the guy was looking at you funny. But
I didn't have a problem.
Yeah, he did.
He had a problem.
Right.
Yeah, that jag.
Yeah.
He had a problem because the people I still hung around with, you know, they drank like I did.
Yeah.
If I saw somebody out and they had one or two beers and left a half a glass on the table, I'd be like, "What's your problem? There's something wrong with you." And surprisingly, I still think that way today when I see that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an odd sense. It's an odd thing. You know, what's up with that? So did you get married while you lived there?
I didn't get married, but I went out with a buddy one night and there was some cute bartenders and we asked him out after work and met him at a 2 a.m. bar. And, I found out that this gal was not happy with her husband, and you know she gave the song and dance, and she had three children, and I think their ages at that time were like 4, 11, and 13, and she drank pretty good. She drank kind of like I did.
Mm-hmm. You know, not quite
as much. So yeah, she was a drinking buddy and you know a companion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, lots of benefits there, and both of us enjoyed things. And, you know, so I married her, and I figured I'd be better if I had a family. So I basically produced a family.
Yeah, instant family. Yeah.
Yeah, at that point, I think I was 26 years old and had absolutely, that was a setup for disaster from day one. I had no parenting skills, no relationship skills.
Yeah, not a whole lot of. Living, so to speak.
No, I was just very angry and didn't want to talk to anyone.
you're looking for, probably looking for normal of some kind.
Some semblance.
Yeah. How long were you together?
We were together for 8 years and married for 5 of them.
And some of them good?
There was some good partying times there.
Yeah.
Very few, though. Very few.
And it got difficult towards the end?
Yeah. You know, the only time there was a good time is when, you know, I hadn't drinking yet and she hadn't drinking, and we both got to, like, that 3 or 4 drink place.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd stay there for, you know.
Is that the Jolly Place?
The Jolly Place for 10 or 15 minutes. Yeah, the Jolly Place.
A fleeting moment.
But, you know, that wasn't enough, so that would get passed up right away, you know.
And, yeah, 10 or 15 minutes, and after that we go to another place, which is the Bad Place.
The Bad Place.
Yeah. Blackout Place?
I would usually pass out before I black out.
Yeah.
I blacked out a few times. It was when I was younger.
Yeah.
But No, at that age, no, I would pass out.
Yeah. And you thought, I think you told me, but we were talking, you thought she had a problem.
I did. I was convinced she had a problem. We, you know, during our marriage, we had a house built, and it was a nice house in a nice neighborhood, and it was pretty evident that, you know, this house that wasn't even a year old yet, when all the furniture in the living room was thrown out the bay window in the middle of the night, and the neighbors kind of saw it, that we didn't fit in. So
Something ain't right at that house.
Something's not right. And, you know, there was, I sought out the couple of neighbors that drank, but none of them drank like I did.
Yeah.
And after a while, they started keeping their distance, too.
Yeah.
So I thought it best that we move. So, you know, I went to talk to an attorney because, of course, I wanted to protect my financial interests. Because,
well, of course.
You know, I put everything into this.
Yeah.
Know, the great me that I am.
Mm-hmm.
And I started talking to him, and he said, well, it sounds like she's got a bit of a problem. You might want to go and talk to these people and have an see about having an evaluation done.
Mm-hmm. So that's what you did.
I did. I went and I opened a dialogue with these folks.
That's very interesting. You know what I'm going to do? Let's take a short, can we take a short break right here? You ready for that?
Sure.
Okay. So I want to read a little something from a friend of ours who knows Phil really well, and he sent this as a possible opening or a possible little statement on our reminder, and it reads like this: "Angry, thin-skinned young man pushes the threshold way out and enters the world of the spirit, blasting open his horizons, keening his spiritual perception, and discovers that he can only do one thing with the newfound knowledge, which is to give it away." And that's his way of describing Phil's journey. So, thanks, John. That's pretty good. So, So let's pick up where we left off, which is so you go to the hospital to get arrangements made for your wife to have an evaluation.
Right.
Okay. And so what happens?
Well, I walked in and I sat down with a man, and they asked me to take a breathalyzer. And I hadn't drank yet that day, so I thought I'd be okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I took a breathalyzer, and they told me, you're like three times the normal limit right now. And I go, you're kidding me. I feel fine. They're like, no, you should be having a hard time walking and slurring your words. And I said, gosh, really? And something went off in my head like, oh, that's interesting. I wonder what it would be like if I wasn't under the influence of drugs and alcohol. Because as I was talking to this guy, he was asking questions. And for the first time in my life, I was being honest. You know, he said, how much do you drink? I said, well, I'm here to talk about my wife. He goes, let's talk about you first. He goes, how much do you drink? I said, well, you know, two or three, 12 packs a day. And before, whenever I went to talk to a doctor or a psychologist, I would say two or three, and I'd leave off the 12 packs a day. But I told this cat the truth, you know, yeah. And I told him about my drug usage and where mm-hmm. I was at with things. And he said, I think you would benefit from our program. And he said, it's a program you can sign yourself in. And he goes, and if you're not doing well and you don't like it, you can sign yourself out. And I go, all right, I'll try it. So, you know, important me, I go out to my car and I get my laptop, and, you know, I get my work phone and, you know, books and all this other important stuff I have to have. And the guy's like, you can't bring that in there. And I go, really? He goes, yeah. Can I bring my cigarettes? He said, certainly. And at that point, you could still smoke there.
Yeah.
You had to go in the room, push two buttons and put the cigarette in the hole and it would light it.
Yeah, they don't give you matches.
No. So I was in this. I was in this place. It was a mental health unit mm-hmm. of a hospital in Hoffman Estates.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there for a day and just kind of checking everybody else out. And I'm thinking, you know what? I don't belong here. These people have some real problems. And there were people with different disorders. You know, there were people that had eating disorders, and a lot of the people looked like. Street people, sort of, you know, but they had mm-hmm. to have insurance to be in there of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember thinking, I don't belong here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they get in this big group and they welcome me, and I've still got the look on, like,
yeah,
screw you.
Right.
You know, and they're I remember they were planting mustard seeds. And I'm thinking, how childish and gay is this?
Yeah.
And, you know, no offense to, you know, people with their gender or anything, just, you know,
yeah,
as
just,
a saying.
Yeah, just a know. Saying, sure.
But, boy, it just seemed kind of screwy. And then, you know, I was there, I couldn't really fall asleep, you know, and they locked the doors. You couldn't get out. And the next day came, the next day was a Saturday, and I wasn't doing so well on Saturday. I'd go to the window and they'd give me pills. And I think they were like Valiums and maybe, you know, Downers or, you know, whatever. They'd give you a handful of pills, you know, and I'd take the pills. And I still wasn't feeling real well. And Rick, third day on Sunday, I wanted a drink so bad. I was sick. I was shaking. I could feel my heart racing. I was all sweaty. And I said, I want to sign myself out. And the lady looked at me and says, well, you can only do that when there's a doctor here, and there's no doctor here today. And I started to have a little bit of a temper
mm-hmm.
problem. And they called the orderlies, and I kind of sized these guys up, and I says, I can take them. And then I really didn't feel well, and I started getting dizzy. And I sat down in a chair, and...
And what was all the sickness?
They told me it was because I haven't had any alcohol. And I had been drinking so much on a regular basis that I was going through withdrawal.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the lady saying my blood pressure was you know, 2 something, a very high number, and my heart rate was 200 and something, and Kong lady, and they said, try to stay calm, you could have a stroke, you can go into cardiac arrest, you know, we're gonna treat you for this. And that's about all I remember. You know, then I woke up, and it had been a couple of days, and I had a needle in my arm, and
nothing that you'd put there.
Nothing that I had put there. But I remember when I woke up and I looked around, I could see out the window and I could see a swing set and a playground. Hmm. And I remember seeing the yellow seats and the blue chains and the red pole on the top.
Hmm.
And I said, my God. And I realized at that moment that I haven't seen color through my eyes in about 17 years.
Wow. That's amazing. And what also what is also amazing is that you were in such denial about your drinking that you didn't even know that you had been drinking so long and so much that you didn't even know what detox was because you'd never gone there.
I never had that.
Yeah.
You know, I occasionally would say, you know, this drinking is getting out of hand because I flipped my car over again and, you know, I got to do something about it, so... You know, I won't drink today.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the day after that, I didn't feel well, and I couldn't go to work. I could go to work when I drank all night and roll into work at, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning and sleep in my car for 2 hours, and I could work and function all day. But if I didn't drink the day before, I couldn't work.
But it never occurred to you why.
Never clicked.
Yeah. So you somehow or another, you started your recovery from that point.
Yes. Yes, I did.
Do you think... It was, well, why did the light come out? I mean, there's a couple of miracles in here. One of them is that you said yes to this guy that you would stay in the first place, you know, like a guy like you that never even really thought seriously about getting sober and didn't, you know, was kind of a, you know, screw-all-y kind of a guy. And this guy says, we really think you ought to stay. And you said yes. I mean, that's a miracle.
Well, I actually thought they could do something that would help me because I didn't feel...
You knew you didn't feel... Something wasn't right.
I didn't feel well. Something wasn't right.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, what the hell? I guess you would call that a moment of clarity.
A moment of clarity. And then you've had moments of clarity since then, like the swing set. I mean, that's huge.
Yeah, that was probably the biggest one I remember.
That you hadn't seen color in 17 years.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if people really know that that's something that can happen, that can really happen, that affects how you view the world that much. You hear
what
people
a huge difference.
Yeah, you hear people talking about, well, I heard the birds, you know, and I saw the sun and all that stuff. But to actually see color, that's amazing. So, how does your sobriety and your recovery progress from that point? What happens?
Well, I stayed in there, then they wanted me to stay 28 days. I think I stayed another 14 days, and then I did an intensive outpatient program because they told me if I liked feeling the way that I felt, that I wouldn't be able to feel that way if I didn't complete their program.
Mm-hmm.
And then they also mentioned the insurance might not cover it if you don't complete it. It was a lot of money. My portion was still a lot of money after the insurance covered it.
It's an incentive.
So, you know, I completed their program. And during the program, a lot of people, you know, they'd spot check people. And, you know, there was a guy that, you know, he took a drink that day because, you know, I had a drink on my best friend's grave, you know, and I could just tell that was bullshit. You know, I could see right through these people and just know because I had been, you know, with the games they were playing.
Right.
And I participated. And I went to IOP, I think, 6, maybe 8 weeks.
Yeah.
3 nights a week.
Yeah.
And that was pretty much my life. I went to work, and I'd go to IOP, and then I'd go to a meeting. And the days I didn't have IOP, I'd go to 1 or 2 meetings.
Yeah. And then you started getting involved in the program from there, and did you do the normal stuff, like get a sponsor and start working steps and things?
Yeah, I had to get a sponsor before they would let me out.
Let you out of IOP?
Yeah. I went to a couple meetings not IOP. They wouldn't let me out of the treatment center.
Oh, they wouldn't. You had to have a sponsor right out of the gate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I went to a couple meetings and I was trying to talk to people, but I couldn't talk in full senses, and I was just spilling coffee all over and stuff. You know, they'd have these meetings in the hospital and I'd go downstairs with some other people and I just...
Yeah.
I liked what they were saying and I felt okay there, but I just could not participate.
Not working, not firing on all eight?
No, no. And I remembered about this kid in high school. He robbed the liquor store in his senior year, his junior year, and all he stole was two handles of booze. No money.
Mm-hmm.
And he got caught, and then he disappeared. And then I met him through, surprisingly enough, a girlfriend. It was her cousin.
Mm-hmm.
And he always had this book and talked about alcoholism. And, you know, we'd go on a vacation. I would go with her family on a vacation. And this cat would go. And he'd go to these meetings. And you see, I kind of thought he was a little weird.
Mm-hmm.
But at that point, that's where I was. And now at this point in my life, I'm thinking, that kid got recovery.
Yeah, now we know what he was doing. Now we know what meetings he was going to, right?
Right. So I scoured the phone books, and his name was still the same, and I called him up. And he goes, you know, it probably wouldn't be a good fit. I haven't been working a real good program for a couple of years, and I'm thinking, what the hell is that? What's a program?
Right.
And he goes, I'm going to have this guy call you.
Yeah.
So, you know, 20 minutes later, they call me, and I go to the payphone, and it's this guy, Kenny.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked him if he'd sponsor me, and he said, sure. And
he was your first sponsor. Yeah.
He was my first sponsor, and he started me through the steps.
Yeah. How would you characterize the first 2 years of your sobriety? How did it go? And you've been sober, what, 13 years, 12, 13 years, 14 years, somewhere in there?
13 and a half years.
Mm-hmm.
My first 2 years of sobriety, I had a lot of good times. But, you know, that first year was a little rough because, you know, I was still married and cohabitating with my ex-drinking partner who continued to drink. And now I was capable.
And she never did get that evaluation, huh?
No, she never. Well, she did eventually, but it was a pretty, it was a rocky year.
Yeah.
You know, there were some things she was doing. She would have a friend over and they'd be drinking and she'd poke fun at me because I'm reading, oh, you just read your book.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you call your sponsor? You seem a little edgy. And, you know, she would tease and taunt me with things. And then it got bad. She was, you know, coming home at 4 o'clock in the morning and I'd go to leave for work and her car would be pushing in the garage door from outside, you know, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter came home, the bus, half day kindergarten, the bus dropped her off. Her mom wasn't at home or was asleep and she had to walk, you know, 6 blocks to a friend's house that she knew from school, you know, and that really bothered me.
Yeah.
And I lived that way for a year, but, you know, and I made time for my daughter whenever I could. I'd take her to meetings where they had a place where she could go that was safe. And, you know, I was going to so many meetings, I feel bad I wasn't able to participate. But they told me that it's like an airplane. If the plane loses oxygen, you have to put the oxygen mask on first or you won't be able to help your child.
Yeah.
And I kind of looked at it like that and felt bad and felt selfish, but I had some respect for the people that were telling me that because you know what? Those people were happy.
Mm-hmm. And so did that. And then they also told you to not make any major changes, right?
They did, not for 1 year.
And so you got a. I know you said you got a divorce.
Yeah, I filed for divorce on my 1 year anniversary.
I get you. So you did what you were told to the letter.
Yeah, March 21st,
yep.
2002. Would have been 1 year. So 2001 was my sobriety.
Now how old's your daughter now?
She is 18.
Yeah, yeah. That's that. I think does it turn out to be have been good advice to you?
Yeah, it was tremendous advice.
Yeah.
Because of that, and you know, because of this program, and my higher power and God. I think my now ex-wife had a moment of clarity because she told the judge, when the judge asked her her using habits, she told him exactly how she used.
Hmm.
And then the court gave me custody.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, now here I am. I'm a year into sobriety. I'm trying to hold down a house. I've got this unrational woman chasing me around. She came to my work. a couple of times, you know, because she knew I'd beat her to confront me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just ugly. It was ugly.
Yeah. But you made it.
I made it.
Yeah.
With, you know, help with a lot of friends.
Yeah.
The program, something that they call in the program the fellowship, Rick.
I've heard that.
And I thought that was all BS. If those people were going out, they'd go bowling, and somewhere they were smoking a joint or something, because how else could they be so happy?
And
part of me stuck around just to see.
Just to make sure they weren't lying.
Yeah. Right. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
Turns out they weren't lying, huh?
No, they weren't. They told me to hang on because, you know.
Now, this friend of ours that we share, this John guy.
Yeah.
He tells me that he thinks that you, when we talk about the spiritual part of the program, that despite the appearance or the little bit of rough around the edges, that you have it, that you got it.
Yeah, he tells me that. I feel that. And, you know, I've had a lot of guys over the last couple of years ask me to sponsor them. So there's something going on. They say in the program that you'll be the last one to notice the miracles that are happening.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's something that just, you know, gradually kind of happens, you know.
But, right. Well, I've known you for a little while, too, and I've seen some stuff. So, yeah. No, that's...
Yeah, and, you know, a big part of that is, you know... The fellowship meetings and, you know, my sponsor, who mm-hmm. was John.
Yep.
I chose him to be my sponsor because of his spiritual connection.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you're sitting in a meeting and a guy's talking about being catapulted into the fifth dimension and really living there, and this is a spiritual world, and looking for where God is not,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that really made me think. And I said, I want to get
somebody.
I want to talk to that dude. And that was many years ago. And, you know, it's been a great road since then.
Well, do you think that the edges have been ground down?
I think they have been quite a bit, Rick. I don't have thin skin. I'm not quick to anger. I enjoy talking to people today. People come up and say hi to me in public. I'm just able to smile and say hi to somebody walking by instead of them looking the other way. It's just really nice, and today, you know, I value those interpersonal relationships.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I still don't have the skills that people that don't have this disease and suffered with it that long. You know, I'm still 17, 18 years behind.
Yeah.
You know, in my social skills and all that stuff. So you know, I'm still a little rough with things, but I don't have that anger and meanness to me today.
Yeah.
You know, that seems to have gone away. But I have to remember, I'm capable of that.
Yeah.
And if I don't do what I'm supposed to be doing, which is, you know, going to, I say 2.5 meetings a week because, you know, some weeks is 3, some weeks is 4, some weeks is 2. But I never go less than 2 meetings a week because that's what I need.
Yeah.
To keep that anger and, you know, that keeps me from forgetting.
It keeps you where you need to be. Yeah. Yeah. That's good. If you could give some advice to maybe some guys out there who have a booze problem and have an anger problem. You know, if you could say a thing or two to them, what would you say?
Well, the grass just may be greener on the other side. For real.
Yeah?
Might
just be better over here?
Yeah. And, gosh, you know, if you get started, you know, go to meetings, get a sponsor, work the program, you know, give it a try. It's not for everybody, but it might be for you, and it'll change your life. It'll be more than you expect. And if it's not working for you, you can always go back out. You know, this program of AA, they'll refund your misery, you mm-hmm. know, if you want. So you really got nothing to lose. It's not going to hurt you.
It's all yours. Yeah. Now, one last thing before we close. And I know we talked a little bit about you lost your grandma not too long ago.
I did.
And you were very close to her.
I was.
Yeah.
I was. As a kid, when... you know, my parents wanted their freedom,
yeah.
you know, and the weekend, you know, we get dumped off at grandma's house. And mm-hmm. she's kind of always been the rock in my life.
Yeah.
When I got sober, I realized just how much faith she had.
Mm.
And as she got sick, she lived to be 95, God bless her.
Mm-hmm.
But she would get sick and she'd be happy.
Mm.
And that just amazed me. And we talked a lot. And she really brought me to believe that, you know, a God is a loving, caring God.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I was younger, I was told that if you do this, you go to hell. You do this, you go to hell. And you know what? I thought, hell, I'm in hell already. What's the difference? You know.
But
she showed me a different way, and it was more from her actions and just how she lived her life.
That's a pretty good role model. That's a pretty good role model.
Yeah, I miss her, but she's still here.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Well, thanks for being with us tonight. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate you taking the time to come out and talk and tell your story.
You're welcome, Rick. Thanks for having me.
So thanks to our listeners, we'll email out reminders for next week's show, usually Thursday or Friday of the week before the show. I think we're going to be, I don't know how much I have to say about this right now, but we're going to go to more of a podcast orientation. You'll still get a link and everything else will still be the same on your end, but we won't be live except occasionally, and we'll probably be putting out 2 to 3 shows a month, and you'll be getting email reminders as to when that's going to be available, but we'll still be available on the Sunday nights as usual, and at any other time you want to tune in.
Absolutely.
Since it's a podcast. Anything else you want to say about that?
I think that about covers it. It just will make it a little bit more available, a little bit easier to find, and a little bit broader of a range of ways to listen to us. So
okay.
Hopefully if you're a regular listener, you might want to, if you've got friends that you think might benefit from that, it'll be easy to send them that link too.
Okay, great. Thanks. Remember to check recoveryinternetradio.com. That's
recoveryinternetradio.com
for all our archive shows, and sign up for our email reminder list. Remember too, that we want to hear from you so we know where you are. So as always, live today, love yourself and your neighbor. Together we'll trudge the happy road to destiny. We hope you've enjoyed the show, and we'll see you next week.
Peace out.